valuation is a very imprecise science. If you're selling a development site and someone, you know, as an agent, you're always looking for someone that thinks you can, you know, they can build it for 10% less than you and sell it for 10% more than you. And that has a massive impact. And one of the issues with development appraisals is at this moment in time, nothing is worth anything because of build costs and the value of affordable housing, because you're not making any money on affordable housing. If you're lucky, you're getting your money back. But our job, very simply from a selling perspective, is knowing who the best buyer is and why.
Welcome to the Property Funder podcast. I'm back again with Jonathan van der Molen. If you didn't catch last week's episode, Jonathan is an experienced residential and development agent based in London with over 40 years of experience in the estate agency and land agency world. Outside of estate agency and land agency, Jonathan is an avid Spurs fan, a golfer, and also a very proud family man. Jonathan, great to have you back again with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Jonathan, we were talking obviously about the genesis of how you came to being where you are now. You're obviously now eight people at Van der Molen Real Estate. You were telling us that you brought in Adil Rashid to work with you on the affordable housing side, which looking like it was a good decision at the time. And also now you're starting to make a foray into the financing side of things as well, which obviously is having a big benefits to you, not only to your business, but also to your clients. What's the end game for Van der Molen Real Estate? You know, obviously you've been through the Blenheim Bishop experience, you've built that up. You sold it, had some interesting, some interesting bumps along the way after that. What's the plan for Van der Molen Real Estate going forwards?
We say jokingly world domination. So what we basically want is we want every client in our sector to talk to us about what they're doing residentially. And we kind of, when we meet everyone for the first time, you might remember, we say we have three golden rules. You know, we trust everyone implicitly because they can only screw us once, and that obviously works both ways. We have to think we're the right people for the job. So if you've got a shop to let or a commercial office building to sell, we'll just refer you to one of our partners. And in an ideal world, and this is probably an age thing really now, that, you know, if you're paying us, we have to like you because life's too short. Or to coin a phrase of a very good friend of mine, if you want aggravation, you can go home. You want to try and enjoy yourself in the office. So I think the affordable housing business has morphed into something slightly different because package deals will be back whilst the HAs are sorting out their problems. But what has developed from that, as you often find in business, where one door closes, another one opens, is the vast majority of the housing associations and probably pretty much most of the local authorities are now looking to buy finished blocks of flats. So one of the ways out for a developer if they're struggling with their sales is most of the local authorities have been given grant by government and will buy complete blocks of flats, private and affordable, and use that grant to convert them to affordable tenure. So we have a number of transactions that we're working on in that field whilst we're waiting for package deals to come back. And we've probably got seven or eight deals that we're very close to agreeing. We haven't done one yet because these things take time. Dealing with a housing association is a bit like dealing with a multi-layered PLC. There are various things you have to go through because the money's public and a lot of them are registered charities. There's valuations, there's surveys, there's board meetings. But what they will give you, unlike a high net worth family office, is whereas most high net worth family offices are looking for a 15 to 20% discount and a 6.5% to 7% gross yield, is generally the HAs and the local authorities will buy at Redbook or a smaller discount to Redbook. So that's what's keeping the affordable housing business going. And again, that with the capital advisory business is it's about income streams. If you're a transaction and a deal business, you never do a certain amount of business every month. You'll have a good month, you'll have a bad month. So December was probably our best month of the year. We're 10 months into our financial year. We've done about 181 million of transactions so far, which we're very happy with. But during December, we completed the sale of a block of 53 flats in North London from a house builder to an Israeli family office. And we completed phase one of an acquisition of 73 houses in Littlehampton for a pension fund. Those two deals were worth 45 million. So the business kind of goes in peaks and troughs like any business. We are very close and we're looking to add some other strings to our bow. So our main weakness probably is most residential, as you probably know, starts off life as commercial. So it was pubs, it was petrol stations, it was industrial. The weakest sector probably at the moment is office buildings, particularly in high street, more residential locations, because there's just no demand for them anymore, or not as much demand as there used to be, particularly with home working. But we don't really have a lot of contacts with the institution. So we're very close to agreeing terms with somebody who's going to be our head of commercial, who will open those doors for us, who's a woman. So we're very excited about, particularly Louisa, my poor EA, as you know, who runs my diary and everything else that goes on, is very excited about having another female in the office. I can't reveal who it is quite yet, maybe by the time this comes out, but very, very experienced, different perspective to us, and will open our door, open those doors. And apart from being able to do more deals, we have a debt to pay to a lot of our clients, because a lot of our clients give us instructions because we're a very good selling agent. But we feel we need to repay that debt by finding them deals as well. So that's part of the reason for doing that. And it's slightly the same with the insolvency work that we do. You know, we are very, very fortunate with the calibre of work that we get and who we get it from. You know, we've done work for RSM, FRP, Begbie's Trainer, Evelyn Partners, Moorfields Assets, and people like Cushman Wakefield, CBRE, Knight Frank. And one of the other reasons that I like to meet with lenders is I think receivership and administration is very much a horses for courses business. So it's always good for the lender to have the right person for the right job. Bit like us, you know, one of the hardest things I ever had to do was I got called by a receiver and said, I've got a £40 million house for you to sell in Mayfair. Would you like it? And I had to bite my lip and say to him, it's just not what we do. Well, I could do it because anyone could sell a great house in Mayfair at the best market value, but we're not best at that. And I think if you're trying, like you said earlier, trying to build a brand and be thing to all men, it only leads to disasters. So I think the idea is to try and get a group of people who will own businesses within our business and will effectively be working with themselves under our brand, and we can all work together. So commercial is part of that. I think we'd like to get more involved in the build to rent and student sectors, but you need to do the necessary deals to do that. So doing our first single family housing deal with a pension fund is a big deal for us. You post it on LinkedIn and all of a sudden a lot of sales directors of house builders who would never answer your emails or calls before are saying, oh, we see you've done that deal. Can you help us with this? So a lot of it is kind of guilty by association. I'd quite like to have a super prime business, because again, a lot of the work we're seeing is super prime, and I think you need somebody in that field. But I think anybody who's got a decent idea who can come in, you know, we're all ears. And I think if you ever want to sell a business, and that's not on my mind at all at the moment because I'm having far too much fun, is you need to be multifaceted and you need to have different income streams. And as you said rightly before, the joys of lettings and management is you may not make a whole pile of money for it, but it's always going to pay your bills in difficult times.
Well, I mean, it does seem like that's a bit of a hole in your, a hole in your offering. No, if you're selling these completed schemes, there will be some people who will want to retain the schemes and rent them out. So does that not present an opportunity for you, or you think that that's actually it's too granular, it's too messy, and it doesn't make sense?
All of those, and I have absolutely no desire to deal with the general public again. And I think there are a lot of people, and part of our relationship with Hamptons and Alconnells and Countrywide is because they help us with values on sales and lettings, is that we pass that work on to them. And again, it just goes back to someone can do better than you, let them. And I think to start that kind of business is very capital expensive very management extensive. And I think we've got more than enough with what we're doing at the moment. I think it's really important not to lose focus.
I think that's fair enough. I mean, look, you've still got a good number of miles left on the clock as far as your career is concerned, but you'll presumably have some eye on the future, on some sort of event, whether some sort of exit event. Is there, you know, you're saying you're having too much fun, but is there a point in the future, and you don't have to be too specific about it, where you're thinking, right, I think I'm going to have to get off the train?
I don't really think about retirement because I love working. I don't think I could stop working. As much as I would love to put more time into my golf, because I'd like to get myself to a sort of, I think I've got an early teens handicap in me. I'm currently 18.8, I think, is my world index. But I had a life-changing event nearly 2 years ago. I have a grandson.
Congratulations.
Is the absolute light of my life. It's just, people sort of talk about it. Having children is wonderful. Walking your daughter down the aisle, which I did a few years ago, is wonderful. But having a grandchild is really, really special. And I think I'm obviously going to want to spend more time with him. My daughter's got another one on the way, which is also really exciting. So there will come a point in time in the next few years when I want to spend a little less time working, because I'm still working long hours, and a little more time with them. So, you know, he stayed at us last night. My wife and I took him to nursery this morning, which I absolutely loved. It was just the best thing. So I think, yeah, look, I've turned 60 last year, but I'm fit and strong, and I still think we've got quite a long way to go. But part of the reason for having partners, which is something I never really had at Blenheim Bishop until the latter stages, is for them to take some of that strain. And part of the reason for having a younger partner, so Sam's 39, is that there's a clear future and direction for the business wherever it goes, whether it's a sale, whether it's not a sale. The truth is, it's not big enough and not producing enough fees to be of interest to one of the big boys. And having done it once, I'm not sure I want to go down that road again. But it's far too early to do that. I think the end game is to create a profitable business, because we all work to make money, but also to be the best niche practice in our field. I think that's really important.
Well, it's refreshing actually to hear that, because I think a lot of people get, you know, people are either in denial about wanting to sell and actually secretly are making moves to do so, or a little bit too keen to sell, and they forget that actually what they have to do is focus on being the best whatever they are that it can be.
Wrong. Someone made me an offer I couldn't refuse. You have to think about your future and what you want to do. But it's not just about me. We have a team of people, all of whom are very committed, all of whom work very hard. And it's just, you know, maybe I'm just one of those footballers who should retire in a couple of years, but probably won't. But I'm really enjoying it still. And we're definitely building some momentum.
I guess in a business, you know, you mentioned particularly in the first episode about all the, you talked about all these people who you met along the way in your career, and you keep saying, the thing that kept resonating with me was that you kept saying, oh, I'm still, he's a dear friend, or he's a lovely man. I feel like you spend a lot of time, you spend a lot of time at work working with people you like and who are friends. And maybe maybe there'll come a time when you're not dealing with as many friends or as many people as you like, and maybe that will be the point where you say, do you know what, it's time to hang up the boots.
Well, it's true, and a lot of them are my age, but I think the vast majority of them will never stop working in some capacity. It's much easier when, you know, if you've got enough money that you don't have to work and you're producing enough income to do that, then that makes the decision that much easier. But yeah, they are, a lot of them are friends first and clients second. And there's actually one particular client who I won't mention, who's given us a lot of work, who's been really, really supportive towards us, who's got a site that I just don't think is worth what he wants for it. And I've said to him, go and talk to these guys. I just don't think we're the best people for it, which is also quite a hard thing to do. But you've got to practice what you preach. And I've learned because I've made mistakes along the way, having done business with friends, that the relationship is, you know, the only thing that matters. And luckily for me, I've got a very small, but, you know, I don't need tons of friends. I've got five or six really, really close mates. So I know anything goes wrong in the middle of the night, I pick up the phone, they'll be there for me. But I think one of the things that, again, you learn with experience, and particularly in the insolvency world, is everybody knows everybody. You make one mistake, you get one thing wrong, you're finished. And unfortunately, one of the joys of being an estate agent, and actually one of the first things I learned in the agency business that I got taught, there were actually two things that I was told. Actually, the first one was definitely Richard Burnstone, which was, you know, I've done a deal with British Airways. They've agreed not to sell property and I've agreed not to carry passengers. But the other one, which is really true, is in the agency world, if things go well, it's generally because the client's a genius. If things go badly, it's because we're crap. And that's just, you know, it's just the way it is. It's probably in any sales business, it's the same. So I think you have to be very conscious. And that's why, you know, we're very lucky. We've got a lot of great people that we work with. And I think that's why we do repeat business, because we try and conduct ourselves in the right way. Do we always get it right? No, of course we don't, because when you're doing quite a large volume of transactions or you're dealing with lots of different people, you can't please all the people all the time. But if you're straight with people, you know, one of the things we do when we're selling is we do a weekly report. And the reason we do a weekly report, show the client how many inquiries we've come, where they've come from, who's interested. People don't like surprises. So if you tell people while you're going along, the outcome is never a surprise, and they can't turn around and go, well, you never told me that, and you never told me this. But again, you just learn that with experience. So I think the benefit I've got this time round with Van der Molen is that I hopefully won't make as many mistakes as I did last time when I had Blenheim Bishop. But also, again, as you get a bit older, it's very energy sapping dealing with people you don't like. It's a bit like litigation. I was very, very lucky. I learned a very, very important lesson about litigation when I worked for Aston Chase. I'd shown somebody a house. 4 months later, they bought it through another agent at a similar price they'd offered when I showed them around, but the vendor hasn't accepted it. And it was a slam dunk in terms of getting the fees. Went to court. I was in the witness box. I was young at the time. And the barrister ripped me to shreds. I was a gibbering wreck. I couldn't even get my sentences out properly. So one of the things that I promised myself was that I would never sue anybody unless it was a slam dunk. And if someone was stupid enough to screw us and didn't want to deal with us again, then so be it. And like I said, but you can only have the benefit of that stuff either because you've got experienced partners or you learn during your journey. Mm.
Well, I was going to ask, I mean, we've still got lots of questions, but I was going to ask a bit later, but I think it's a good segue. What's the most difficult transaction you'd ever been involved with? But I was also, but then maybe a different way of putting it is, what's been the most difficult situation professionally you've been involved in throughout your career?
I think when you make your first sort of major cock up, you make your first major mistake, it's hard admitting to it. I can't think of it actually any particular transaction, certainly that I can talk about, that has really been a disaster for anybody. You get situations where people make mistakes. You're often reliant on what the client tells you in terms of the property, and there's only a certain amount of due diligence you can do. So we've been involved in situations where there's been things we haven't been told, but that's what you have PI cover for, and that's why you have caveats on the sales particulars. And one of the things that we try and do now when we're selling is we try and make sure we have so we spend a lot more time maybe than some agents on the back end. So have we got all the information? Have we got all of the answers to the questions that we might be asked? Are there any solutions to these problems that we may need to look at? And I think part of what you need to do, because the market is tough, you know, getting any deals You know, you used to have to dot the I's and cross the T's. Now we're going through the whole bloody alphabet to get anything over the line. It is very, very difficult. So what we try and do now when we're selling is we take a step back and say, well, what is the exit? What do we need to do to get this property into its best possible shape to enable us to sell it for the seller at the best possible price? So is it an exit? If it's a site, is there a forward fund? If it's a vacant property, is there a service department operator or a local authority that might take a lease on it? I think everyone needs as much help as they can. I've had situations, certainly not with Van der Molen, but with Blenheim Bishops, where we made mistakes. And I've been bawled out and screamed at, and rightly so. But I managed in those circumstances to have been sort of old enough and ugly enough to say, actually, I'm sorry, I got it wrong. And I think if anyone was looking for advice on business and what to do, and I'm certainly not a doyen when it comes to it, but I think one of the most important things is if you know there's a problem, deal with it quickly. Because otherwise, my wife Melissa's late grandfather, Seymour, when I first met him before we were married, said to me, you know, with any problem in life, it's like a cancer. And if you don't cut it out and deal with it early, it grows and grows and grows and can do untenable damage to a situation. And I think that was a great piece of advice. When you're young, you sometimes think, I don't need to worry about that, it'll be okay. But it's not. So I think if you make mistakes, you really need to hold your hands up and say, look, we've done this wrong. And I think that's part of the reason now that we are very much sticking to what we know and making sure if we don't, we've got someone that does. Yeah. So our partners are Hamptons, Connells, Countrywide. We've got that covered now. And that's also enabled us to look at sites in parts of the country that we hadn't before, because we were London and the South East in the past. We've got great planning consultants, great architects, great project managers, office leasing. My daughter Isabella, she'd kill me if I didn't refer to her anyway, does office leasing in central London. We've got freehold managing agents. So we look at ourselves as a bit of a menu. So if you've got something in the residential property sector, come and speak to us. We've got quite a big family office business. So we're working with a big Middle Eastern family office at the moment that have a whole load of assets through London. They've got a house in a very expensive part of Northwest London. And basically, actually, we brought in our friends at Aston Chase and a chap called Ian Green, who's a very good agent in St John's Wood. They're handling the sale. They're paying us a small percentage of the fee for the introduction, which means we can asset manage it for the client because they like the way we do things. But I think I've been lucky. There's been no major disasters. I've not really fallen out with many of the people that I've met over the years, or at least I'd like to think I haven't.
Have you ever had to walk away from a deal because someone dodgy was involved, maybe you weren't aware of at the outset, or, you know, someone either you discovered there was a, you know, the seller was quite dodgy, or actually someone approached you wanting to buy a site you were involved with, and you kind of said, put your hand up and said, I don't want anything to do with this. I mean, I'm guessing it might have happened at some point in your career.
Back in the old days, there was no such thing as KYC. KYC is actually, whilst it's a pain in the arse for everybody, it's actually quite good because it's a system which enables you to make sure the people you're dealing with are bona fide. And I kind of didn't sort of find out at the time, but I did have one particular instance at Blenheim Bishop where we were selling a part built scheme in East London. I won't say who the bank or the receiver was at the time because it wasn't appropriate, but it was a difficult sale. It was 2009. There wasn't much money around. And basically there was the borrower who was being quite aggressive, wanted to buy the property back. And I just basically said to him, look, you just need to show us the cash because this is unfundable, or we can't do the deal. You know, we just can't do the deal with you. And it turned out, to cut a long story short, that he'd had some political connections in an organisation where if you'd have known at the time, you probably never would have dealt with them, but we didn't.
Right, okay.
So, but yeah, I don't think we've had anyone who's turned out to be a major drug dealer or fraudster or anybody like that. But again, I think that's just because of the nature of sort of who we've been dealing with and what we've been dealing with. I think that's probably more prevalent if you're selling homes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Very interesting. In our dealings, particularly in the last 18 to 24 months, you know, when you've been, I think, being kind, you've been very realistic about valuations and about the market, which I guess is a reflection of, as you say, it's a difficult market. Looking forwards, do you see any light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, we were talking about there's going to be a significant lack of new stock coming through in terms of the development land because planning is such a nightmare. You were touching on the Gateway 2 stuff as well. Can you see the sort of the nose of, you know, for consented sites and completed stock, can you see the nose of the plane starting to pick up a little bit? Is there some light at the end of the tunnel from this sort of difficult sort of quagmire that we're in at the moment?
Yeah, I think there is. Look, the biggest issue is value. Whether we all like it or not, values have dropped. Part of that on the new home side is because Help to Buy, or we called it Help to Sell, has artificially inflated values. So something that was £500 a foot almost overnight became £600, £650 a foot. If you're a developer or a lender, you worked off those values, those are now back down, maybe not to £500 a foot, but to £550 a foot. It's also much more difficult. You know, one of the things that I found very lucky for us, you know, when I was young, was the cost of property in relation to wages was much lower. For young people, it's really, really tough if you don't have the help of banker mum and dad to get on the property ladder. So I think for developers, there are, without Help to Buy, a lot less buyers. There are rumours that Labour are working on something. I'm not quite sure how they're going to make it work, because whilst it worked on the one hand getting people on the ladder, I think unfortunately a lot of people who've used Help to Buy now probably can't get their money back. And it will be interesting to see where the government's 40% sits in that particular capital stack. I think there'll be issues with that. But it's all about value. You've got to give people a reason to buy. So whether you're buying a development site, a block of flats, a studio flat in Croydon, a mansion in Mayfair, you have to give people a reason to buy, and that's price. But unfortunately, everything in the development stack that we've talked about, construction costs, lending costs, sales values, have all gone in the wrong direction at the same time. I think from a lender's perspective, you get this in any market. We kind of have this sort of story that we tell. If you look at the last couple of decades, there are an awful lot of people who've made an awful lot of money. A lot of those people think they know everything about everything because they've been successful in one particular field. And quite a lot of them will also have a mate who's a property lender or developer who's done well, and they'll take one look at them and think, well, if they've done it, how hard can it be? And now an awful lot of them are finding out. So yeah. I think the big difference between this market and last time round is there are a lot more lenders. There is a lot more, there's a lack of experience, particularly on the recovery side, in a lot of those lenders. So luckily for me, with quite a lot of the big lenders, a lot of the people that are in recoveries were in recoveries last time round. I knew them, didn't start that way, obviously, we're just experienced lenders, morphed into recoveries, and they're now doing the same again. So they don't have to listen to my bullshit story 50 times before they give me some business. We kind of know, they know what we're doing. I think there is going to be, I think what we're seeing probably at the moment is the tip of the iceberg. I think there are a lot more problems in a lot more loan books because there's just more of them at the moment.
But things luckily, get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, I think it will get worse before it gets better. But luckily, 90% of us need to trade to live. So there are developers that if they want to support their businesses and they want to keep their teams employed, they need to buy. That's going to come down to price. And I think, unfortunately, at the moment, there are some people that just cannot afford to listen to the market. And we've had a number of experiences where, with a couple of finished blocks of flats, where we've been instructed by a receiver, we can't quite get the lender their money back. And they've said, OK, we're going to go down the road and sell the flats individually. 9 months later, they haven't sold a unit.
Yeah, what we're hearing from your peers is that actually apartment blocks are really difficult to shift, particularly one and two bedroom flats. They actually said that the three beds are the ones that are selling. So the ones that you didn't, the developer probably didn't want, especially in great, we're talking Greater London, the units that the developers probably didn't want to have to provide because they thought, who wants to buy a three bedroom flat? Actually, the three bedroom flats are selling because people not being able to afford, let's say, a three bedroom house, families are electing to buy three bedroom flats. So they've got, a room for mum and dad, room for one of the kids, and a guest room per se. Whereas the ones and twos, which you would expect to be the ones that fly first, they're not selling.
Well, I think also there's been a number of times when investors, mainly starting from Asia and the Middle East, so when interest rates were zero and you could get a 5 or 6% yield on buying residential property, an awful lot, if you go through London at night and you go to places like Nine Elms, for example, lots of lights are not on because these flats have been bought by investors. Now that's changed. You can get 5 and a bit percent on a bond. Labour have obviously changed the rules again from a tax perspective. So a lot of buy-to-let landlords are just selling because you can't make any money. And my personal view on residential investment anyway is it doesn't yield. You buy residential property for capital growth, unless you're buying at a discount to vacant possession value. And that vacant possession value is only what someone will pay for it at that point in time. So I think, it's a really difficult set of circumstances for everybody. But I think as you said, it's probably going to get a bit worse before it gets better. And an awful lot of it is going to depend on who the lender is, where the money's come from. So there's an awful lot of new lenders who've got credit lines, maybe from private equity, from bigger banks. I think a lot of the schemes have gone wrong. The developer has used someone else's equity, so they haven't had very much of their own skin in the game, and they've just been clinging on for dear life, waiting for a miracle to happen, something to get them out of trouble.
There's no one on a white horse that's gonna knight shining armor's gonna rescue them, unfortunately. And we obviously see it with a very small handful of cases in our own loan book. There's a real element of head in the sand about certain individuals, and they're in. I think they're either in complete denial or maybe they're well aware and they just want to stick their heads in the sand and pretend that it's not happening. But unfortunately, it's happening.
Yeah, and sometimes you can get lucky. Our job, valuation is a very imprecise science. If you're selling a development site and someone, as an agent, you're always looking for someone that thinks you can. They can build it for 10% less than you and sell it for 10% more than you. And that has a massive impact. And one of the issues with development appraisals is at this moment in time, nothing is worth anything because of build costs and the value of affordable housing, because you're not making any money on affordable housing. If you're lucky, you're getting your money back. But our job, very simply from a selling perspective, is knowing who the best buyer is and why. And one of the ways we do that is, as a firm, as a team, we see 35 to 40 people every week. An awful lot of them, unfortunately, having to listen to all my nonsense. But with Sam and the sales team, it's very, very important to know who's in the market and why. Who has a scheme they're finishing? Who doesn't want to lose their contractors? They want to get them onto the next job. So market intelligence is really, really important. But ultimately, the only real test of what something is worth is what someone will pay for it at a point in time. And unfortunately, the problem with red book valuations, and I've been quite a big critic of a lot of them, is a lot of the big firms do not engage with their sales teams, which I find astonishing. A lot of the build costs, we've looked at something recently, I'm not going to say where, but a six-storey building in a red book valuation is in a build cost of £154 a foot.
What? Where?
And I said, out of London, but doesn't matter where it is. You can't build, barely build Lego for £154 a foot. And I said, did nobody question this? Why? How did you get this? Well, this is what the developers built the last phase for. And I said, no, he hasn't. It just hasn't happened. We had another one where the valuation was based on comparable evidence. So it was in Hampstead in NW3. But the only thing that this particular address had in common with NW3 was the postcode. All the comparable evidence had been used on the best streets in Hampstead. So,
well, what was this? The sort of the wrong end of Swiss Cottage, was it, or something like that?
No, but it wasn't even that good.
Right.
So, one of the issues with valuation is it is a very imprecise science, and one of the problems we're seeing at the moment is because there's been a lack of transactions, there is a massive shortage of comparable evidence, which is what valuers normally work on.
We actually looked at a lending opportunity in, ironically, in the village. I say village, but you know, the town where I live, and it's, you know, a reasonably smart, affluent area. You know, nice enough location, nice enough plot. The product is so-so, but it's okay. There's a scheme around the corner, and you know, about 18 months ago, they were marketing these units, townhouses, at a crazy price, but they managed to get a few away, about close to £1,000 a foot. It's just for reference, where I live, as nice as it is, it's not £1,000 a square foot area. You know, it's 600, maybe 700 on a good day, right? And if someone wants to pay £1,000 a foot, you know, DM me and you'd be more than welcome to buy my house off me for that. You know, so, but the fact we've got the valuation and the valuer had just leaned on these comps, and you go, just going, this is, it just makes no sense. I mean, our exposure, our loan exposure, if we'd lent what they needed us to lend them on the deal, was, you know, was going to be higher than what we thought that the GDV was. And obviously, being local to the area and knowing a developer who's building a house just around the corner, probably the most prolific developer in the village or in the area. And I messaged him. I said, Rob, you know, these guys are looking to get £1,000 a foot. What do you reckon? He said, they're mad. No chance. No way. You know, it's probably out by £300 or £400 a foot. So, you know, but the irony was, I said the valuation was carried out by a firm that we know quite well, but they're a specialist valuation firm that does a lot of work for specialist lenders. They don't have an agency division of their own. And I said, well, this would actually be one of those times when you'd want a Savills or a Knight Frank to be on the valuation, because at least they'd speak to their agency colleagues and they get some comps from them. But maybe by the sounds of things, what you would say is that actually they wouldn't, and you'd be none the wiser in that situation.
Yeah, I think, look, it depends who it is, but often most of what we see in the Red Book valuation is inaccurate. So, and that's part of the problem. And the big issue we're seeing is there will be an original Red Book valuation for anyone that's watching is up here. The new Red Book will be here, but we're generally here.
Yeah.
Like I said, look, valuations are very imprecise science, and there are a number of things where we've just got the value, you know, we've just sold two sites recently, very good examples. You know, we thought the values of those sites were £750,000 and £1 million less than they were, but the right buyer was found. And that right buyer may well go on and make a lot more money than we thought from doing that. So I think it's simply, you know, value is one thing. Finding the right buyer can be something completely different. But as long as those two align, everybody's happy.
Do you think that banks in particular place too much reliance and too much weight now on RICS valuations?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. But I think part of it comes down to what we went to see we're seeing a lot of lenders, and a lot of them, because they've got young people in the team and they haven't seen a property crash before, we've been asked to talk about the market. And I think it goes back to everything is going wrong at the moment. So, you know, if you've got a scheme that started 18 months ago, the chances of that contractor being able to deliver at the build price that he quoted them, whether he knew it was right or wrong at the time, is highly unlikely. Because, again, you've got so many lenders, there are an awful lot of inexperienced monitoring surveyors. And as you all know, an awful lot of developers are very slick and have got very well-run machines and nice fancy cars and are very persuasive. So one of the things we've said to lenders is, you know, if you are dishing money out, you might want to make the occasional trip down to site just to make sure that the money is actually going on that site, not going to fill a hole elsewhere where a developer's got other exposure. And again, when you're getting a Red Book valuation, just take a look at Rightmove or phone a few local agents. You know, one of the things that we do is we'll just do mystery shopping. So the problem for an estate agent is you make money from doing deals. The minute a valuer calls you, you just want to get rid of that guy as quickly as you can, because he's blocking up a call from your next potential buyer. Whereas what we do is, and again, it's not a pretty imprecise science, but what we'll do is we'll go to Hamptons or Connells or Countrywide and say to them, right, what are these flats worth to sell them today? Not to sell them in 6 or 12 months' time, because we don't know where the market's going to be. And the way the world is changing so rapidly at the moment, we don't know where the world is going to be. So it's only about what it's worth now. It's not worth about what it's worth in 5 minutes or 5 months or 5 years. But it's always going to be a very imprecise science. It's a bit like that saying, you know, you're only as good as your last deal or your next deal. I'm not really quite sure which one it is. But once you've done the first deal, it's history. You're moving on to the next one. Mm. So it's not easy. But when you're in an environment which is politically unstable, which economically is unstable, one of the things that I do is I read the Times every week. And I'd suggest to every young person, you know, you should, whilst the internet is a great source of information, it's not always accurate, but you should always read what's going on in business. It's really important. You know, if you're going to do one thing, read the business sector of the Times every Sunday, just to give you a feel for what's going on in the world, which I know is very boring, and TikTok is far more interesting and far more fun, and I watch it myself. It's a good laugh from time to time. But I think in particular, you need to have a knowledge of what's going on in the world to get a greater understanding of how things work. And I think valuation is one of those things. You know, whilst, you know, someone might pay £1 million, the guy next door might pay £2 million for something. Very difficult. No, you just don't.
Well, I think we're going to start the wind down now, Jonathan. So I'm going to ask our closing tradition, which is, what advice would you give to your, maybe let's say your 16-year-old self, and why?
Probably one of the things I don't do, one of the things I try and do in meetings, I know I have an awful lot of verbal diaries, is listen more than you speak. You know, there's a reason you've got two ears and one mouth. Listening is really, really important. Listening to what the client wants and the advice that you get. There is definitely no substitute for hard work, as far as I'm concerned, unless you're a genius and you get some bright idea that nobody else has. I don't think there's any substitute for hard work. And try not to bullshit a bullshitter, because, you know, they're generally, if you're dealing with someone older than you, they're more experienced than you. But you never know what life's going to throw at you. You never know what path's going to take you, and what's going on globally at the moment has a massive impact on the economy. So I think if you work hard and you're honest with people, and if there's a problem you tell them quickly, then you're always going to have a chance to succeed.
Well, Jonathan, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure recording these couple of episodes with you. So thanks for joining us. If you can just remind everyone where people can find you on the internet and how they can reach out to you. Just let them know.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Our website is www.vandermolenre.co.uk. My personal and my team's contact numbers are on there, or you can look for our individual, my individual LinkedIn page is Jonathan Vandermolen, or Vandermolen Real Estate's LinkedIn page.
Brilliant. And I've been Michael Dean. You can find me on the internet at @property_funder across the multiple platforms. Thanks very much for joining us. Thank you to Jonathan again, and we look forward to seeing you again on the next one. Thanks and goodbye.